Energy from food is measured in calories, but although many people count calories and cut calories, they may not know the actual role that they play in our bodies. This week's Please Explain is all about what calories are, how they're measured, how we burn them, and if they differ from food to food. And joining us are Dr. Kelly D. Brownell, Dean of the Sanford School of Public Policy and Professor of Public Policy at Duke University, and Russell Rising, Research Associate in the Metabolic Laboratory at the Obesity Research Center at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of you to our show. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Kelly, what is a calorie?
You can think of calories as the fuel for the body, much like gasoline would be for a car, that your body needs nutrition, and calories are part of the overall nutrition picture. You take in calories just like you put gasoline into your car. You burn calories just like your car burns gasoline. And if you consume more than you're burning off, you're going to gain weight. And the opposite will happen if you're burning more than you consume. And calories are a real issue for the American's public health.
We're talking about food calories, but are they used to measure other units of energy?
They are. Calories are a measure of energy. We think of them in terms of our food, but you could also use calories to measure heat energy or other things like that.
Well, when it comes to food, do calories measure the amount of potential energy that's contained in that food or something else?
Well, the way calories are measured is you burn a food in something called a bomb calorimeter, and how much heat it gives off gives you the number of calories. And so a food contains a certain number of calories, which means it will give you a certain amount of energy when you consume it. And so, yes, it's a measure of the potential energy that a food has.
Russell, what's the Atwater system?
Well, that is actually derived in the early part of the 20th century. And what they did is they made an attempt to figure out a way to calculate the caloric content of specific items in foods like fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. So it's the old 944, 9 kilocalories per gram for fats and 4 kilocalories per gram for both protein and carbohydrates. So essentially, it's metabolizable energy. So what Dr. Kelly is talking about is gross energy. When you burn a food in a bomb calorimeter and you measure the heat emitted, that's the total gross energy of the food. But the Atwater values, they factored out the digestion process. So the Atwater values represent the amount of energy the body is actually using to absorb and metabolize the foods.
Is the Atwater system the one that we tend to count calories with? You make it sound like it's the less accurate of the two.
It's horribly inaccurate. The reason being that it was done in the early part of the 20th century, and the composition of foods have changed a lot since then. So if you read, I read a recent review of it, and it turns out actually they're underestimates. The real values are closer to like 10.55. And I might explain why there's a lot of inaccuracies in some of the measurements in foods or calculations in foods.
Now, Kelly, would 10 grams of carbohydrates, fat, and protein vary in the amount of calories that they contain?
Yes, because as Dr. Rising just explained, if you're consuming the same weight of protein, carbohydrates, or fat, you'll be getting different calories if you're consuming fat compared to the other two. So the most effective way of consuming calories, if that were your goal, would be to consume fat.
Because it's already halfway there.
Yeah, it's 2.25 more calorically dense than carbohydrate and protein if you go by the Atwater values.
Well, how are calorie counts in foods measured, Russell?
Basically, they use the Atwater values. They go to a database like the USDA, and they look up each of the ingredients, and they determine the amount of carbohydrate, fat, and protein in those ingredients, and they times it by 944. That's basically how they do it.
So you take a donut or a burrito or a frappuccino, and you measure the calories, theoretically,
you calculate it based on the Atwater values.
And is that what restaurants and manufacturers do?
Pretty much. That's what they do. They go to a database and use Atwater values to calculate it, unless some of the manufacturers happen to have a bomb calorimeter, and they might make some measurements. But it's a tad tedious, a little bit labor-intensive, and kind of expensive. So that's why they just go to formulations like the Atwater values and make a calculation.
Now, Kelly, why don't they use calorimeters?
There's no need. Well, it's as you were just told, it's a laborious process, and it costs money and it takes time. And if you can just take information from tables and create estimates rather than getting exact amounts, just an easier process.
Does it also aid them because the estimates are so variable? They can do they ever fudge the counts?
Yes, as I recall, the law requires calorie labeling to be accurate within certain limits. And I don't remember exactly what the limits are, but yes, and if the companies use something that is an established standard that's taken from some table that people use widely, then they probably feel that they're doing their due diligence.
Now, Russell, do they, when they're making something, do they put it all together and then go through the process of measuring it, or is it more likely that they estimate the caloric count ingredient by ingredient?
They try to do it ingredient by ingredient. The USDA database now even has condiments on it, so you could look up each ingredient, but some of the more exotic stuff or ethnic foods, they don't quite have that, so they just tend to guess it, you know, and they tend to be way off most of the time.
And you have looked into some of them. What are some of the biggest disparities you've come across?
Well, the Chipotle burrito is underestimated by about almost 400 calories.
400 calories?
Yeah,
but they posted
They posted a range of 670 to 9-something. It came in at 1,200.
And what about the most accurate? Are some places more accurate than others?
Believe it or not, Subway was within 5 calories of what it said on the board. We measured something. They said 375 for one of their turkey sandwiches. It came in with our lab at 370. So they were extremely accurate. And Frappuccino wasn't too bad. It was only off by like 20 calories.
Well, when I see that calorie count listed, I just assume it's totally accurate. But not only over by 20 calories is not really what I'm thinking about.
They're off by 20, 30, 40, 50% low most of the time.
My guests are Russell Rising, research associate in the Metabolic Laboratory at the Obesity Research Center at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital, Dr. Kelly D. Brunell, Dean of the Sanford School of Public Policy, Professor of Public Policy at Duke University. We're talking about calories on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org, and you can participate by giving us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Kelly, is counting calories a good way to control how much we eat and monitor our weight?
Yes, there are different ways to do it, but overall calories make the most sense because they're the unit of how much we're eating versus how much energy we're expending, and therefore the balance. So yes, knowing calories is a good way to, and counting calories is a good way to keep control of your weight. And it's why what Dr. Rising just said is really important, that many, many people count on these calorie levels, labels that they see to be accurate. And you're exactly right, Leonard, if you're plus or minus 20 calories for something that might have 2 or 3 or 4 or 1,000 calories, and it's not so bad. But when somebody's off by 400 calories and then you're off by 30, 40, 50%, then that's a real concern. And it's going to make people greatly underestimate the number of calories they're getting in their day-to-day life. So it's important that these numbers be tightened up. Now,
Not just be eating one burrito.
Well, that's exactly right. In the defense of restaurants, sometimes there are, you know, you have a chef or you have somebody who's putting something together, even if it's an assembly line fast food kind of place, and you know exactly how much beans or cheese they put into a burrito will vary from person to person and time to time. So there has to be at least some flexibility in the calorie levels that get reported. But if they're consistently underreporting calories and the underreporting is large, then that's a great concern.
Yeah, we tested about maybe, because I had another agency send us some foods, and we've done about maybe 20 samples, 2 within a Starbucks and Subway within a few calories of what they said on the board. The rest of them are way off.
And yet in New York City, restaurants with 15 or more locations and the ones with the standardized menu are required to post the number of calories in the foods that they serve. As part of the Affordable Care Act, chain restaurants are also required to post calorie counts. Do you think that this is a good idea from a public health standpoint, or since the calorie counts are so off in many cases, does it even really matter?
Well, I read a study this morning done by the Woods Foundation, and they actually looked at whether people actually pay attention to it. And the answer is no, it doesn't do anything. Unless you're educated in what a calorie is and how your body uses them, it doesn't do anything. People are still eating the same amount of calories, and they're just not paying attention to what's up on the board.
Kelly, I'd take a different point of view on that. There are a variety of studies on whether posting calories on restaurant menus make a difference, and they're mixed. Some studies suggest that they don't make much of a difference, and others suggest they do. But I believe that irrespective of whether they're making a difference in diet, they're likely to at some point, just like food labels on packages. Plus, consumers have the right to know. When you're in a building, there are exit signs that show you how to get out if there's an emergency. There may not be a study showing that that actually saves lives, but you have the right to know that. You have a right to know where your clothing is made and what's in it, and that's why there are tags on clothing.
But at least you know where the clothing is made. It's accurate. You can go to the particular location and see what the factory is. But
calorie
counts, you're off by 20, 30, 40, 50%. I mean, it's got to be some standardization to bring this more in line.
Okay, but let's talk about when we have to make decisions for ourselves. For example, when we're cooking at home, does it depend on, I'm assuming meat and sugar produce a lot of the calories that we consume. Does it depend on what we're eating? Is beef, lamb, chicken, pork, are any of those likely to give us more calories? Fish, shrimp, lobster?
Depends how lean it is. I mean, some of your leaner meats or some of your meats that have higher fat content, you're going to consume more fat in it versus some of the other types of meats that have less fat. It depends on the marbling in the meat. And how you cook it, what you add to it.
And how much you cook.
Yeah, how much? Most of the time, the portion sizes are way too much, you know, especially restaurants.
What about the packaged foods? Are there, because they also put calorie counts on a lot of the foods that we buy in the stores, are they?
They're the worst offenders. We've measured brand muffins. And they're one of the ones that are off. They would say 600 calories on the package, and we measured it at 975.
Is it because of sugar mostly?
It's not standardized the amount of the ingredients they put in or the size of the muffin. So, you know, especially smaller, like these foods that are sold in the bodegas in New York City, they might be made with, you know, handmade by small manufacturers, and the ingredients and the amount of ingredients and type of ingredients vary all over the place. So that might explain why they're so far off. You know, we measured a healthy sandwich rated at 375, came in at 650. I mean, so if you look at it, it says healthy eating, whatever, on the sandwich, but it was under. So it depends on how they put it together.
Well, Kelly, we also have people who are proud to say that they give you more food. They give you larger servings. So have we become accustomed to larger and larger serving sizes?
Well, we sure have. Americans value the quantity of food over its quality, and you see them voting with their wallet lots of times by going to fast food restaurants and going to family restaurants that serve large portions. It's only one of the things that comprise what we've called a toxic food environment, but large portions are certainly part of it. Studies show very clearly that if people are served large portions, they consume more, and they generally don't realize it and make up for it later. So that's one of the reasons, one of the rationales that New York City and Mayor Bloomberg had for restricting the portion size on sodas.
Well, people will drink diet sodas, drink low-fat or no-fat milk. Is that helping them at all?
We don't know. There's really mixed science on this. Take the diet sodas, for example. Some studies suggest that they might help people control weight, and other studies suggest the opposite. There's some really fascinating animal studies showing that animals fed diet versions of something like yogurt could end up eating more and having a high level of body fat when they're allowed to eat whatever they want after these test meals. And the idea is that the body takes sweet taste as a signal that calories are about to be delivered, and it activates a metabolic process in order to make use of the calories. And though if the body continually gets fooled by the sweet taste but calories aren't delivered, it screws things up in some way, and that leads to ultimately overeating. So we don't really know, but I don't think anybody could say very clearly that these diet products have been conclusively shown to be helping people.
We also hear often about empty calories. Is there such a thing?
Yes. Go to the average bar. Alcohol is 7 kilocalories per gram. So after a couple of beers, you probably consume 500-600 calories. And add a couple of Black Russians to that, and then the next thing you know, you could be up to around 1,500, 2,000 calories on a night on the town. It doesn't take much. And it goes nowhere except to body weight gain. You know, some is given off as heat, but most of it goes to body weight gain.
And Leonard, the classic example of empty calories would be sugar-sweetened beverages and the sodas. They deliver no nutrition at all, and they're very high in sugar. And that's one of the reasons why the country, all around the country, there are campaigns going on to decrease consumption of these sugared beverages.
We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk more with my two guests, Dr. Kelly D. Brownell, Dean of the Sanford School of Public Policy, Professor of Public Policy at Duke University, Russell Rising, Research Associate in the Metabolic Laboratory at the Obesity Research Center at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital. And we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we're back with today's Please Explain. We're looking at calories with Russell Rising of St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital and Dr. Kelly D. Brownell of Duke University, and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's take a call from Joan from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, it's so nice. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, it's so nice being here, Leonard. I just love your show, and you're terrific.
You.
I've been listening to you for years. I'm in a precarious...
I hope you're losing weight. Oh, you don't want to lose weight, right?
No. I've been pretty much the same weight for years. I haven't had a problem with weight because I don't eat sugar and I don't drink alcohol. But recently I had an accident, and I just can't seem to gain the pounds that I've lost. And if I told you what I ate, I mean, I just eat well. I don't eat sugar, and I don't eat, and I don't drink alcohol. You know.
So Kelly, is what
and
should she do?
And
should
I
she
don't
drink?
Overeat
should she drink alcohol and eat more sugar to put on some weight?
I don't know that many people would make that recommendation, but I'm not in a position to make medical recommendations for Joan. She ought to check with her doctor about that, or perhaps a registered dietitian who could help her make some good food choices and meet her weight goals at the same time.
But are there certain foods that are better than others? For example, is there a difference between raw food calories and cooked food calories, Russell?
Well, a cooked food, I would suspect, would be more, because when you cook food, it breaks down some of the bonds in the fiber that are normally not digestible. So it might help to cook it. And she should maybe just, you know, she should pay my lab a visit. We can measure how many calories she actually needs using our whole room indirect calorimeter. And from that, we could recommend a diet, you know, just add 10% to it, and she should start gaining a little bit of weight. You want to do it slowly, of course, but you need to have an accurate measure of your caloric expenditure first so you can see, because from the accident, maybe your metabolic rates increase, as typically happens if you're healing from an accident.
Kelly, is there a difference between whole food calories like brown rice or almonds or an apple and processed food calories from white bread or ice cream or Cheetos?
Well, a lot of times the processed foods have good things taken away from them. And so you're going to get more calories and less good things like fiber in processed foods compared to whole foods. Now, that doesn't mean that one should have a totally whole food diet, but to the extent possible, you can eat whole foods. It's not a bad idea.
Now, could Joan just have a very good metabolism and burn calories more efficiently than some other people? How does the body burn calories?
Well, basically, I mean, when you consume it, you know, if you're the average-sized individual, you know, you run on a mixture of carbohydrates and fats and proteins normally. And we measure something in the lab called a respiratory quotient, which is a ratio of oxygen to carbon dioxide. And normally you sit at about 0.85. So maybe she's one of these people that has, she just maybe gives off more of her calories as heat versus actually driving metabolic processes. That's why it would be a good idea for her to actually have a measurement of her energy expenditure.
And how does that whole room calorimeter work?
Well, you come into the lab, and the instrument I would use for her is our smaller whole room indirect calorimeter. It's about the size of a walk-in closet. You lay down in a very comfortable bed, listen to NPR, and for 1 hour, we're measuring your oxygen consumption and carbon dioxide production. And from that, we determine your resting metabolic rate, which is 80% of your total energy expenditure. And from that, we can determine how many calories you need on a daily basis. It's only a one-hour measurement. And that way we can find out maybe you do have a higher metabolic rate, probably from the accident, and we just recommend a diet accordingly.
So each of us has a different caloric rate that is appropriate to us.
Everybody's an individual. That's why when you start doing global recommendations, it might work for 10 people, but the other 20 are getting fat. And that's the problem. You know, you need more easy to use accurate technology to start making inferences about weight loss, you know, treatment for obesity, weight maintenance, weight gain. You know, you need to measure what we call the energy expenditure side of the energy balance equation, not just the intake, but both sides. Measuring the caloric content of food you're consuming and also how you're burning your calories. And that way you just tweak it accordingly to get the desired effect.
Ted from Long Island, you're on the air.
Leonard, your Facebook friend Ted here, arguably you are the best interviewer in broadcasting ever.
You know what, I'm going to insist now that everyone who called pay me a compliment before we get going.
Listen, in the last year, I lost about 40 pounds, and I had been on Atkins, and I had been on this diet and that diet and so on. The one that I finally found worked was this MetaFast using their food products. But the key, and I've now been able to create my own foods, the key was to drop my carbohydrate intake. All calories are not created alike as far as I found, and I'd love to know what your guests think about that. If I restricted myself to no more than 100 grams of carbohydrates a day, and, of course, I cut out alcohol and so on. No pasta, no rice, no potatoes. My wife inadvertently lost weight because she didn't make these things for herself alone, and she didn't need to lose weight, and she did. Is there something to be said for which of these? If you drop your fat down, you drop your carbs down, you will lose weight even if your caloric intake sort of remains the same.
Well, the thing is, most of those diets are not very good, first of all. The best way to lose weight is eat a balanced diet, roughly 50% carbohydrate, 30%, 35% fat, and the rest protein. Depending, it varies, of course, from diet to diet. Just a balanced diet, but less of it, and increase your physical activity. That's the healthiest way to lose weight. What you're doing when you really drop the carbohydrate, you're forcing the body to burn more fat, and it goes into what we call emergency mode. And it's great as long as you stay on that diet, but as soon as you have one cheat day, everything goes out the window.
Which are the best exercises for burning off calories? Kelly?
Well, any exercise is good for you, but the aerobic ones where you're moving your body through space will tend to be good calorie burners and, of course, do good things for your risk for things like heart disease.
Can we trust the calorie counters on exercise machines?
They're just predictors, and I helped create some of those exercise counters and exercise machines. So they're okay, especially if you put in your weight, because a lot of those predictions, most of the predictive capability is due to your weight. So if it asks you for your weight, you're getting a little closer to what the actual caloric burn is on those machines.
Although I'm always amused that I start the machine, and within 10 seconds, it says I've already burned off one calorie. I've barely moved.
Well, it's probably not bad. If you're running on a treadmill and the thing says, you know, 300 calories an hour and you're running at a moderate pace, that's actually pretty good because we've done a lot of those studies years ago at the NIH determining that. So as long as it asks you for your weight and your age, you're getting closer to the real number. You're probably within 10% of what you actually are.
Jack from the East Village, hi, you're on the air. Jack, are you there? Okay, well, Jack was there, I assume.
Hello?
Yes,
hello?
You're the other Jack. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I've been curious about the different kinds of sugars that they advertise or use. I don't even have white sugar in my house, and I'm the same weight now that I'm a senior that I was at 16. But I don't have white sugar in the house, but the people say corn syrup. Some people say brown sugar. Some people say raw sugar. Some people say the light brown sugar. Is there a difference between the different kinds of sugars in terms of their metabolization and in terms of the calories that they activate?
Kelly?
The science on these things is changing all the time. You could take high fructose corn syrup as an example. At one point, people thought it was fine, and then people thought it was bad, and then people thought it was fine, and now people think it's bad again. And I think it'll just take more science for us to know the difference between these kind of things. But if what one is concerned about is body weight, then the calories that these sugars are delivering would probably be the major concern.
Yeah, simple sugars especially deliver a lot of calories because, you know, it's sweet, it tastes good, and you tend to consume a lot of it, and a lot of foods have a lot of it in it. So that's part of your problem, you know, those muffins and everything else you like to eat, Dunkin' Donuts, very high in simple sugar content.
Bob from Rico Park, how are you on the air?
Leonard, first all I'd like to say is God has nothing on you. That's how good a person you are. I have to continue the compliments. My question is, you know, I'm a vegetarian. Bill Clinton became a vegetarian. if you can compare and contrast 400 calories of kale versus 400 calories of saturated cheeseburger, is the saturated fat, I know it's equal calories, but is the saturated fat basically killing you and killing Americans, number one in heart attacks in the United States?
Well, I can respond. There are a lot of things that food delivers, some good and some bad. So the cheeseburger delivers saturated fat, and it delivers whatever the calories are, plus generally a lot of salt, so that's not very good. If you have 400 calories worth of kale, then you're getting the same number of calories, but you're not getting the fat, you're getting more fiber, and you're getting a lot of nutrients that you wouldn't get from the other foods.
Plus it slows the absorption of all the nutrients. So, you know, it's not as big a hit on the metabolism. You don't have this abrupt spiking of your insulin or any of that to deal with. That's why vegetables are so good.
A listener named Michelle asks if there are foods that burn calories. She mentions hot peppers. I guess we know they're hot, but does that mean they burn anything?
Not really. I mean, you burn calories anyway. As soon as you consume and absorb something, you're burning calories. So there's no, like, octane booster or anything you can consume to rev up the metabolism. Maybe caffeine will rev up the metabolism a little bit, but that's just short term. It's only a couple hours, depending on how many cups of coffee you drink. So if you want to drink coffee all day long, that'd be fine. But you'll be so wired, you know, it won't be really worth it. So there's really nothing out there other than just plain balanced diet and exercise to burn calories. Exercise is great because if you do like we did a spinning class, just say, for 1 hour hard, you have something called a post-exercise metabolic rate. So even though you stop exercising and you're walking home, your metabolism elevated for a couple hours, and there's where you get the weight loss, right there.
Fred asks, if the calorie count is off, then it's probably true that the quantities of sodium, cholesterol, saturated fats, etc., are also inaccurate. Should we make that assumption?
It could be. I never measured it, but you can assume it, but you'd have to measure it to be sure. I can only account for the caloric content of foods being, you know, horribly inaccurate. Those other things I don't know without actually, you know, making measurements.
It's really important that we get it right on these things, because people are using these decisions, this information, to make decisions that are affecting their life and their health. So the government ought to make sure that these numbers are accurate.
And we are getting food labels that break down the amount of fiber, sugar, salt, carbohydrates, along with the calories. And I know I look at those things, and I assume that if I buy the yogurt that says it has fewer calories than the one that has more calories, that I'm getting those 90 calories instead of the 160 calories. And now I'm afraid to trust any of that, even if it's the same brand.
Well, the best way, if you're average weight or maintaining a normal weight, the best way is what the scale says. So if you're weighing yourself, say, once a week, and it starts to inch upward, whatever you're consuming obviously is too much, so you back it off a little bit. If the weight comes down to where it's supposed to be, then wherever you're at, you hold it there, regardless of what it says on the food label. So that's how they do it at the National Institutes of Health. We weigh subjects on a balance, and we may just maintain their weight and tweak their diet accordingly.
Another listener suggests just using smaller plates.
There's been studies about that, because the plate has gotten large in America. A teacher of mine years ago told a funny story when he purchased an old house. It was built in the 40s. His plates wouldn't fit in the cabinets. The reason was, when those cabinets were built, plates were 9 inches. Now the average dinner plate is 12 inches. His 12-inch dinner plate wouldn't fit in his cabinet designed for 9-inch plates. So plates have gotten bigger, and that's part of the problem. Bigger plates means more on the plate, which means people finish what's on the plate.
Now, we have very little time, but another listener wonders why Subway's calorie counts are so much better than some of the other fast food places.
The one or two people I talked to, plus the producer who made that HBO video where that was on, said that the employees tend to be trained to be more, you know, they're trained, they're more highly trained to keep the amounts of ingredients equal from sandwich to sandwich to sandwich. There's less variability among the ingredients. So that's the only thing we can think of, is just to do a better job when you get a burrito that's supposed to be 700 calories. The ingredient amounts in that burrito are the same, whether they make one or 100 burritos, versus the other restaurants that it varies all over the place.
My thanks to both of you for being on our show. Russell Rising, Research Associate in the Metabolic Laboratory at the Obesity Research Center at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital, and Dr. Kelly D. Brunell, Dean of the Sanford School of Public Policy, Professor of Public Policy at Duke University. It's been a real pleasure having both of you on today's Please Explain.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard.